The Ireland-Portugal Business Network is comprised of more than 200 member companies based in Portugal and Ireland. These companies are from a wide range of industries and professions and represent in excess of 25,000 people.
This is just for recording. So thank you, everyone. Around this time last year, we had on our last year's sustainability conference, we had a panel about nutrition. And the big takeaway for me was that we need to be eating more plants. You know, something like 40 different plants every month into your diet sounds like a lot. But when you think about it, and I've tried this over the year, it's like it's actually manageable between all the herbs, all the spices, all the leafy greens, all the vegetables, all the fruits, all count. But we've got Pat here who will give us an overview, maybe Pat, to start with horticulture. I'm very proud to say when I visit a supermarket here in Portugal, I see Irish beef, I see Irish dairy, but I'm yet to see Irish basil. So where is horticulture in Ireland at the moment, if you want to give us an overview?
I suppose it's on a downward trajectory since I went to college, which is a long time ago. It's on a spiral compared to then. It's on a downward trajectory constantly on an annual basis. And that doesn't mean necessarily proportionally there's less being produced. It means there's less people producing vegetables in Ireland than there was 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, literally. So the change is quite rapid. However, the technological advancements, we have just in the last 2 years, my son has taken over a unit in Moorpark, which is an internationally famous dairy research facility. But more than just research, they have a unit in there called MIT, Moorpark Technologies. So it's Moorpark Technologies is a spin out of the dairy industry. So my journey began in farming before I was born. We're on the farm in the middle 1700s, we're on the farm. And I came to a dilemma in the same as growers in Ireland at the moment are coming, so I don't want to waste your time on a long story, but my parents produced vegetables in the 60s and 70s. They emigrated to London. I was born in London, typical Irish story. We're in Kilburn, got a bit of money, came back home to the farm, and it was around the time the dairy industry was evolving in Ireland, and the dairy industry, I don't think we talk about it enough in the plant or horticultural industry. As a teenager, I remember bringing the milk to the creamery rather than the creamery coming to me for the milk. And that all has changed now. So it's the creamery who comes to the farmer for the milk. And if you read the papers in recent years, the creamery wants to come to more farmers for milk because they have a supply chain problem now. Not enough milk. So the dairy industry is a little bit of an example of where the plant-based industry can go. So we set up this room in the middle of all these bullocks, I'll call them, farmer-type mentality. And basically, we started using dairy tech for the plant industry. So to cut to the chase, the big problem we have in Ireland and in Portugal, it's fairly apparent as well, is that the horticulture industry thinks about growing stuff, and it's all about fresh produce, and it's all about getting the stuff into the supermarkets. It's all about the big names. I won't name one in particular, but it's all about being part of the supply chain for the big stores where we all go into, we pick up a plastic bag, we put it in our shopping trolley, that's our farming for the week. And that's where we get our food. And that's fine. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but behind every one of those packs that you pick up is waste that in some cases go to animals that don't need it. But they proportionally put waste carrots. Some of it goes to landfill, some of it goes to biodigesters. Very low income way of getting rid of your waste. So our focus in our biotanics business, through my son joining the company, he's a biotechnologist. He graduated out of NUIG. He joined us. He did all our research on, back 10 years ago, he was doing our research on free access to science papers through his student card. So we had our own little access to all the international papers through him. So he did all our research. We since subscribed to some of those. But we recognized at that stage that unless we follow a working model to transform some of our crops into the stuff of ingredients. So right now we have a collaboration here in Portugal with sweet potato. We're turning sweet potato into a concentrated puree, and we have now onboarded three multinational clients for that puree. So this puree can be made out of oversized, undersized, in the long term as we build scale, oversized, undersized, somewhat blemished. The British call them the wonky veg. Mm-hmm. So we do this with wasabi as well, and we're now beginning to do it with a crop called yacón. And our product development now has established. Now, for a small business in a small rural area, we believe that's our direction. And plant-based is a recent phenomenon, but it's an ancient dietary.
Yeah, of course. And I suppose this is the Ireland-Portugal event, but probably with the troublesome geopolitical situation the world finds itself in. You know, perhaps talking from a European standpoint in terms of food security, we see the issues that, you know, countries like Mexico and Canada are having as a result of a sweep of a pen in Washington. Would you have fear for, you know, European food security, or how do you see that working out?
Well, this was happening anyway. If you look at sweet potato, which is something of a bit of a obsession with me, but we are involved with other crops. This has happened to sweet potato in the last 3-5 years. COVID, freight costs, containers being locked up has all changed the landscape actually for sweet potato. We introduced sweet potato into the Netherlands, Belgium, Germany, even Denmark, even in Norway from a farmer perspective back in 2011. It was only in 2016 when the scale really hit the fan that, you know, we had to figure out how are we going to fulfill the supply chain. So our sweet potato business is based on genetics from Louisiana State University. They're the breeders. We bring them to Europe. We test them in every region across Europe. And before around 2010-11, there was no production of sweet potato in Belgium, Netherlands, France, north of France, there was in the south, Germany. So through these varieties that we tested and introduced, there is now substantially scaling local sweet potato production. And that's when the ping came in my head about this sustainability stuff I've been hearing a lot about back 7 or 8 years ago. This is filling the sustainability gap in sweet potato. So then it evolved in Egypt because Europe is not able to produce everything itself. That's just not going to happen. So we have a seasonal licensing system then for Egypt, and Morocco is possible. So those peripheral countries are really important for the sustainability story in Egypt. So we can't have it 100% what the Rainbow Warrior type message might be. We have to have a little bit of, you know, collaboration with countries outside of Europe. It's simple fact. We have a lot of problems because of that cloud you see over there this year, as Fernando, our general manager in the sweet potato business, will testify. We've had a lot of weather problems in Portugal this year already. It's only March.
And in terms back home of, you said that the number of producers has dropped significantly, and I suppose the strong have survived. Is there optimism within the sector of this huge increase in demand? Like, obviously, you're a really good example, and the more I talk to you, the more I think a half an hour just is not going to be enough. But do you see a lot of innovation embracing technology within the sector, within those, you know, 4 or 5 key players?
It's difficult because innovation takes time, it takes money, and you have to spend the money before you get the return. And then there is a depression on prices in the plant-based, if you want to call it that, food sector, crop sector. It's always about the price, and sustainability is what your obligation is, and obligations cost money. So it's hard to get a farmer optimistic, and I inherit the same trait. So you're not going to get me saying that there's a lot of optimism about, because if you read the media and read everything, it's just simple fact, it's not being portrayed. But I think the reality of the situation, farmers are eternal optimists, otherwise they wouldn't get up out of bed in the morning. So they just don't like admitting this level of optimism because they're afraid. And I have it at home locally, they're afraid if they buy a new car, someone will think they're making money. So there is this kind of underlying necessity to, you know, downplay.
And is that next generation of farmer, you know, I mean, they have to be, it's not just about plowing the land, it's about being, like, there's a serious, significant entrepreneurial, clearly, aspect to it, where, you know, they need to be good negotiators, they need to be good business people.
There's unbelievably great young people out there. I mean, it's like, if I compare in my day and I look at my sons or I look at some of the younger people working for us, they're way smarter and better than us to deal with the 21st century. So look, there's no doubt that there's young people who get it. They're trying to fit into a system that was designed by people of the past, and that's not easy. So, you know, we all have to change, my age group and them and their age group need to change a little bit. There's a bit of stuff going on there that's not so admirable, but there was stuff going on in our generation that was not so admirable too. So I have great confidence that the young guys of the future, if we give them the future, can deal with this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's men and women out there in their 20s and 30s now. They're not kids. They've grown up a lot quicker in some cases. Now look, there is this snowflake stuff going around, but you have to learn. They are the future, so you have to learn how to attract them. And that's our business. Our business, there's no way our farm was going to continue, even for me, was going to continue for what I had a vision for my sons. Not that I have a vision for them, but they have their own minds. And there was no way they were going to be milking cows, looking after cattle at 12 o'clock in the night, getting up to look at cows calf. And they weren't going to do that. They made that very clear when they were even teenagers.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the future of Biotonics is pretty safe, to be fair. Going back to your own youth, I might have misinterpreted when you said this to me first, when your time in college was spent working in hydroponics. I probably know there's some students that have their own little hydroponic setup in their bedroom, but perhaps it's the perception that they're growing weed. I misinterpreted what you said. So do you want to perhaps clarify your time in college with hydroponics?
So it's really interesting what's happening for me personally, to think about 1984, that we had a hydroponic system in our college. It wasn't a university.
And do you want to give an overview of just what hydroponics is?
So hydroponics is the growing of plants using water, hence the name hydro. And, you know, the ponics bit is what I call the skills. So basically, you bring nutrients, you bring water, and you bring the plants, you put them together. That's what's happening anyway. The soil is a carrier, obviously, of the nutrients. Do I prefer soil to hydroponics? Yes, I prefer soil to hydroponics. But it's a diminishing, asset in some regions. There's loads of it in other regions, but you have to bring the produce to the region where it's being consumed. And, you know, hydroponics is a tool, in my opinion. In 1984, I can't even believe I'm saying that long ago, but in 1984, we had a lecturer in our college, Kildalton, and he was a master of hydroponics. He taught himself. And it's simply a sump, a pump, a network, it trickles, and it grows. And we had several crops, chrysanthemum, freesia, tomato, cucumber, peppers, that we grew in 1984 very successfully in hydroponics. If anything, the world went backwards then for about 20-something years because some of these rules and regulations and sustainability messages weren't really that urgent. But now in the last 5 years, everybody's a sustainability expert. So we have to look at it. But Mrs. O'Leary's cow, I put in that document I gave you, Mrs. O'Leary's cow legend in Chicago was how the Great Chicago Fire, it's an Irish story, as it would be from Chicago. Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lamp. The lamp set fire to the straw. And some legend says that was how the Great Fire of Chicago began. It was urban farming. She had cows behind her house in the city. And there was many farms in the 19th century and early 20th century in cities. So urban farming either is no big deal compared to what it was.
Yeah, and my understanding, we set up Farmany, I suppose, to give you a little bit of background to Farmany. Farmany is a vertical farming company that was set up 5 years ago, just before the pandemic. And we set up vertical farms around the world. So we set up a number in Ireland, but also one in Beirut, one in Canada. And following on from Pat's definition of hydroponics, so vertical farming makes use of hydroponics, so growing plants on water and nutrient-rich water, but also under grow lighting. So in the years where cannabis production, you know, medicinal cannabis production across the world has pumped billions of dollars into R&D of grow lighting technology. And a nice side of that is that vertical farming has now become a lot more efficient than it would have been back in Pat's college years, where you would have been dealing with a very high-powered, high-energy lamp. So vertical farming, the benefits of it would be that rather than traditional agriculture, you're not limited geographically. So these farms can be located anywhere in an urban setting. They can make use of infrastructure that's already there in these, you know, cities and towns. Because it's a controlled environment, it means that you're basically controlling, giving the perfect conditions to plants to grow. And therefore, it in a controlled environment, it doesn't require pesticides. And because in a hydroponic system, the water is recirculating throughout, it means that you're using about 80, 90% less water than traditional agriculture. So they're the big kind of pitches towards vertical farming. You know, a challenge perhaps, and certainly has been with a lot of major, highly funded vertical farming startups in the last number of years that have failed because of the level of investment that was required to scale. So I suppose Farmany, perhaps if we were more ambitious, we would have failed quicker. But the fact that we started as a small vertical farming company where we provided affordable modular systems, it meant that we probably avoided that, you know, large the large failure rate that we saw within other investments. So, Pat, with vertical farming and, you know, talking about urban renewal, talking about, you know, community, developing communities, where do you see vertical farming's position in that scenario? Is it practical?
Yeah, it's practical if you don't approach it with impractical ambitions, and that's the problem. It's a very succinct and simple problem. There's a book called The Intelligence Trap, and it should be read.
By me?
No. The theory of the intelligence trap is you get highly intelligent people moving into sectors that they know nothing about, but due to their reputation in finance, in whatever it is, they're mistaken for experts and listened to. And that has been the victim of the economic crash. I have a brother who's involved in this agri-finance side of things. He asks me more questions than he gives me information. And basically, the big problem I've seen through my lifetime with vertical farming ambition is because it didn't start yesterday. We had a vertical farm in our lab back in 2006. So we bought a laboratory in 2006 as part of the farm production, and that's how we got into plant IP, which is another part of our business. We control royalties of plant breeders' rights, and they came through our laboratory. The business in Portugal was based on the laboratory in Ireland having the license for the genetic rights to the varieties. So without vertical farming, as I would see vertical farming, we have no business. That is just simple. It didn't come out of a milking parlor or a cow shed. It came out of a lab, and it's a vertical farming lab. And we have capacity in a, it's probably the growing rooms in the lab are about the size of this, probably smaller than this hall, which give us a capacity to produce about 2.5 million if we're mad enough to do it. We don't, because it's too costly. So now we subcontract our planting material for our ornamental business. So we have a landscape ornamental business as well, which is where we started on the farm with production. All of that depends on vertical plant lab production. And it's in sterile conditions. Because of the sterile and building, our environmental control is relatively precise. We use air conditioners. We use cooling systems. We even have some shelves which have a cooling system to cool the roots, because we deal with plants from the tropics. So sweet potato, we have to keep a temperature of 21 to 23 degrees Celsius in the room. But for our wasabi, we have to keep a temperature of 13 to 15 degrees for that. They'll die. They'll literally die. So that's our version of vertical farming. Now, we know about it since 2006 because we have to pay from, we're all self-funded. We don't have investors or anything in our business in Ireland. And basically, we have to watch the pennies. And vertical farming is a big savior for us, if you want to classify that. But it is the same as your vertical farming. The difference is the value of the crop that's going in. So if I shut up on this topic and say I'm a believer in vertical farming, I'm one of the biggest cynics in Ireland of vertical farming, because it hurts when it goes wrong. Yeah. And we're a small business, so it hurts bigger.
Yeah. I think that point you're making about those, there's so many examples of it. I think straight away of Manchester United, people coming in to a football club with their business acumen and maybe it not going too well. But from our own experience, you know, like case studies that have, you know, I love that case study about Navin, the entrepreneurial center. And I'd be interested to hear more about the vertical farm. But there's a college in Dublin city centre called Belvedere, and you know, we set up a vertical farm in a new building on their roof. And in that school, that students, I think they have various modules. You know, one of them would be coding, which I think is also popular amongst the students. But their number one most popular module to study is vertical farming. So they've got this amazing, it's like aquaculture and hydroponics on the roof of the building. But they're now supplying all the local restaurants. Well, not all, but like certainly five or six local restaurants, premium restaurants in Dublin, from their farm. And I think that's a really amazing story. And that's coming from a college. So it's like, you know, you talk about fostering that entrepreneurial talent. There's a good example of it. And we still get a lot of calls from, you know, architects who thankfully a lot of the cars are being moved out of the cities. So you end up with all this infrastructure, which is a major challenge when you're setting up a vertical farm, is if you don't have the infrastructure in place, that's quite a high cost. So there's a high entry there. But cities, both here in Portugal and back at home, have all these, you know, derelict buildings that can't necessarily be switched into accommodation straight away. And it's can they be switched into, you know, vertical farming hubs that are producing for their local restaurants. And there's the other aspect of this. And I know, because we recently, back maybe 3 years ago, we joined in Porto, where we're based. Myself and Katie, we were on a list for allotments, which there was a serious queue for. And we just this year got an allotment in Porto. It's like a 5 meter by 5 meter plot of land in a beautiful garden at the back of an old hospital, 15 minutes walk from where we are. And I can see the community aspect of that. We've been in Porto. I feel like we have a good network of friends, you know, over 4 years. But I know that just from attending an allotment, you know, every Saturday for a couple of weeks, you meet so many more people. There's families there with children working these allotments. But equally, there's a lot of outhouses around this area that I feel could be turned into vertical farms. And there would be equal engagement from a community point of view in that using technology and innovation to produce for local communities, directly, like, so complete reduction of food miles. So I think that's a big opportunity.
Yeah, the big Achilles heel in vertical farming in the way that you describe it is Achilles himself, the people. The problem we've seen with personal friends of mine and other people that I'm acquainted with that are turning their hand to vertical farming, what has to be understood about vertical farming is it's a sped up version of what happens outside. And microbes, contamination, bad stuff grows too. And bad stuff causes salmonella. And there has been salad-related outbreaks. So we need to do it right. Mm-hmm. And that's not a deterrent because it happens on the land. It's everywhere in agriculture. But some people don't take on board that it is everywhere in agriculture. So the controlling, and it's in, you know, pathogen get into a vertical farm and it rips through it in seconds, not hours, not days, minutes, seconds, and it contaminates everything. So the control, like your Radix software, there's a reason for this. It's not just fancy kind of 21st century stuff. It's controlling something and it's going back to the training and education. I don't see it. I certainly don't see it in Ireland. I don't see people being trained properly for the future of input of vertical farming. So education in vertical farming is critical because you're going to be reading in the newspaper, and it already has happened. You're going to be reading in the newspaper, somebody got salmonella, I thought that was, and then you get this reaction that it's not what they thought it was. So I think, and that's only one little aspect of vertical farming that highlights the necessity for awareness training and proper management through your Radix type software systems and instrumentation, AI and agri-tech. They all sound really out there, cloudy stuff, but they do control. And that's the difference between 1984
and I would say, like, obviously embracing technology and embracing the innovations, like you talk about, since 1984. I mean, you know, I remember in my limited experience within vertical farming over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, when we started out that grow software, you know, understanding plant sensors. Cycles, yes, sensors.
Sensors are the big thing. It's not the software; it's actually the software controls the sensors, but the amount of agri-tech software that's out there, and some of those people are the forgotten people in agriculture. They're as valid as the guy who used to be able to plow a straight line or able to be a good farmer, because now that science is potentially saving the world food ecosystem. And grumpy old guys like me, there's too many of us out there criticizing it, and that's the problem. It's kind of seen as a threat. I got abuse on a radio station one day for a misconceived notion that we were trying to replace. I had nothing to do with replacing beef or milk or whatever. God's sake, my cousins would kill me first of all if I was the one cousin with 500 cows. He'd be the first lad to slit my throat if I was downing it. But apart from that issue, it's not a either.
No, that's a really, I mean, similarly, you know, we're perhaps the guys you're talking about in terms of, I mean, the background of Farmley was, you know, it's a friend from college, Dan, who spent some time working for Kerry Group, you know, one of the largest food ingredient companies, Irish, from Kerry, obviously, in the world. But he spent some time in Asia managing some, you know, plants over there. And in Asia, he saw the impact of vertical farming. He also understood from his home farm in Tipperary the challenges of farming in Ireland at the moment. So we set up Farmony, you know, to try and certainly, I think the misperception of it would be that, you know, it's here to take over and that technology is here to take over. Vertical farming, from my point of view, you know, remains in the context of Irish producers. It's something that can support. It's like AI. It's like, you know, you could look at AI and be very negative towards it, but it's like a calculator. It's something that is another tool to help you be more efficient on your farm. It's like, instead of growing your herbs in Ireland, you know, or your produce in Ireland over the summer months, you know, when the sun barely shines, to be fair, but then being replaced by importers, produce coming from around the world, why not produce all year round, you know, through having a combination of, you know, embracing technology, using vertical farming when it's appropriate, and then obviously continuing. So I think the key point there, Pat, is that this is about a new ecosystem within food production, of which vertical farming, amongst others, has a part to play. And then in terms of urban planning and greening cities, you know, maybe to finish on an example with Paris, you know, I think they've, as a European capital, I think they've come a long way in terms of not necessarily just vertical farming, but in terms of what they're doing within their city to try and promote urban agriculture. I think you had some kids.
I suppose Arnold won't like it and wouldn't allow it. We could be here for the day talking about this topic. And as people passionate about what we do, we tend to spend too much time talking anyway. But basically, if you look at the whole history now of vertical farming as we know it, said Captain Kirk, basically it's not what we thought it was. And there's a little bit of a halftime session to be had. A few people need to get around in a huddle. They need to talk about what went wrong. Thankfully, it was people who had billions of euros and dollars anyway to burn, that burned most of the money, so it's not so bad. There's been a nice bit of education now. We know what's possible. We don't know yet what's impossible, but we know what's possible to control. So all these examples are out there. I did a little paper there for you on loads of little links you can click on. The world isn't short of information when you want to look at the success and failure factors. They might have some of the failure stuff taken down offline by now. But basically, you know, there's loads of learning now and pressing a little bit of a redial. But for sure, vertical farming in the sustainability spectrum, farming in the sustainability spectrum, and AI and sensor technology. Somebody needs to plug them in properly in the right order with the right funding.
Brilliant. I feel like we should finish perhaps with you giving an overview of the connections that you've made between Ireland and Portugal, you know, the business you're doing here, because I think for everything that we're trying to do with the Ireland-Portugal Business Network, it's creating connections between the two countries, but I think you would be up on a pedestal in terms of what you've of the business that you're doing.
Well, there's a few things in Portugal that are pretty obvious to everybody who lives here. Mostly, the sun is better than Ireland. It's got a nice temperate climate. It's got quite an availability of land, although as a percentage of the country's geographic area, it has a surprisingly small percentage of land being used. It's got some water issues down in the south. Thankfully, we located up near Santarém, where the water issues are probably, poor Fernando there is suffering with overwater at the moment. We have too much water, but that will pass. So Ireland, I picked the crop, and our business niche is we work on forgotten crops. That's it. We have a crop called Yacón. We're working on taro. Some of them were never properly commercialized yet in Europe. Portugal and Spain has had sweet potato for 400 years, and still it didn't grow them properly till recently. But the consumer demand now has come up on sweet potato. The diversity of sweet potato as a nutritional product, and it is all about the nutrition. It's not all about the farming. It's about getting the nutrition to people through farming. Mm-hmm. Proper nutrition, dense nutrition, proper breeding. So Portugal gives us the opportunity to bring the science and technology that I learned when I was younger in college and in my experimentation and waste of money in some cases, good choices in other cases, but it was our money to waste, so we were careful with it. So we brought it to Portugal in the beginning in about 2011, 12, 13, 14. We formed a joint venture with a Lisbon-based family business investment fund. We set up a company called Nativa Land in Mouge, and it's been profitable from there on in. There wasn't a startup loss. There wasn't dramatic, massive investment funding like there was for vertical farming. It's horizontal-based, it's land-based, and we supply from Portugal quite a percentage of the sweet potato that are being grown in the Netherlands, in France, in Belgium, through the planting material and the right varieties. It's not complicated. And we've shifted, literally, the dynamics from European sweet potato production, from American and other Ecuador, South America, which was becoming unsustainable anyway, to a higher percentage that is locally grown for a season of delivery between September and March. And we have other partners elsewhere who are able to deliver. So we've got now our varieties going into a 12-month sustainable supply chain to the fresh produce industry. And now in Portugal, we're doing a vertical integration of that through our biotanics work in Moor Park again. We made 8 little bottles of sweet potato concentrate in Moor Park using dairy technology. We brought those bottles to 2 multinational FMCG producers of bakery and other products. And now, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've set up the production of that product in Portugal. So we've industrialized this crop. We've come to a point now where the scale up, we have been scaling every year. That's one example of a crop shared between Ireland. There's a Nativa Land Ireland and there's a Nativa Land Portugal. And then our biotanics company owns the laboratory and does all the services too. So that vertical integration could not have happened without the collaboration between Ireland and Portugal, sun, cloud. We've overcome everything.
Listen, I think that's a brilliant success story to end the conversation. So thanks a million to Pat. Over to you, Arnold.
This has been a production of the IPBN in partnership with Pinkroom. For more information, visit us online at island-portugal.com and on LinkedIn at Island Portugal Business Network. For more IPBN podcasts, find us on Spotify or visit our website for the full list of episodes.